everybody. Welcome to Do Guys Buy Movies. This is one of your co-hosts, Chris Gasperi.
This is Frank Pellicone.
You're listening to episode 115 of The Spin Chagrin, and last week's category was, take a deep breath, the rough around the edges guy from Boston who doesn't have the best social graces but has a heart of gold. So I'm not going to repeat that like I normally do. Frank, what did you come up with for the Adam Sandler category?
Right, so I figured I'd watch some Happy Madison movies that I had never seen, just to torture myself, I guess. So I watched two, and the first one I watched, while it was produced by Happy Madison, it doesn't necessarily fit this category at all, so then I had to watch another one. I don't know, which also might only partially fit the category, but was definitely a treat. So the first movie I watched was the Netflix movie The Wrong Missy.
Okay.
It's from 2020. Yeah, 2020. Directed by a guy named Tyler Spindell and produced by Happy Madison. Stars Sandler stalwart David Spade as a nerdy businessman that was left by his fiance for another dude and is looking for love, basically.
In all the wrong places?
I don't know. He's not really looking in any places. He looks in one place, and then that's it, really. So he goes on a blind date, and he meets this woman, Missy, who's, first of all, like, he walks in and he gets a text saying, you know, I'm wearing a blue dress at the bar, and he walks up and it's a pregnant woman, and he starts kind of like flirting with her and because she's attractive, because he thinks he's a date. And then Roman Reigns comes up and is like, what are you doing, asshole? And they almost get in a fight. And then Laura Lapkus, who I guess is like a comedian, she pops up and turns out that she was just like pranking David Spade for their first like blind date. So they try to set her up as being this like ridiculously grotesque like pest almost, but anyway, the problem with this movie is you're supposed to gradually become endeared to Missy, but you're also supposed to like kind of root for David Spade the whole time. But the thing is David Spade's character is just kind of a vapid prick with like no personality.
Him?
Yeah, I know. And the Missy character, even though like she's kind of crazy, is still engaging and warm-hearted, and you know, she just overeager and outgoing or whatever. So it fails almost immediately from the outset because you're really rooting for Missy the whole time. So anyway, so they go on this blind date and David Spade is immediately like disgusted by her. And, you know, he's a guy, he doesn't drink and all he does is like work. And he reads, I can't remember the name of the author, but he reads like spy thriller novels. And
so these are, so those, at least those three characteristics are David Spade, like stretching his acting chops.
Yeah, the bounds of cruelty. So Missy's like, I don't really trust somebody that doesn't drink. Like, were you an alcoholic? You know, did you have bad experiences? Did you drink a lot when you were younger? And he's like, no, I've just never drank. So he tries to escape her by going to the bathroom and crawling out the window. But then she catches him in the bath. I don't know. It's a ridiculous scene. Anyway. So he ends up climbing out the window and falling like a story and a half and breaking his leg. And she ends up setting his leg. And then that's the end of that part. So a couple months later, he's going on a business trip for his job. He's like some middle manager at a firm that does something. I can't remember what they do. And he accidentally runs into this like beautiful woman and they mistakenly switch their luggage. So when he tries to get on his plane, he doesn't have the right boarding pass. So they eventually find each other and realize they've switched luggage, which is like the setup to like some generic like 90s romantic comedy. And then they end up having a drink together while they're waiting for their like replacement flights or whatever. And they find out they're basically like the same person. Like they both read the same crime thrillers. They both were cheated on by their ex who left them. Neither of them have ever drank and have no interest in drinking. So they end up like making out in a fucking broom closet and exchanging numbers. And so her name is also Missy. So Spade finds out they're having this like big corporate retreat in Hawaii and they're allowed to bring a plus one. So he's been texting this woman like increasingly like erotic texts back and forth. This woman he met in the airport. And finally he's like, hey, you know, I'm going on a trip to Hawaii. Do you want to go with me? And she says yes. And he's like, I'll leave you a ticket, you know, at the counter. So he's on the plane and he's all excited. And there's this weird scene where, Hurley from Lost is sitting next to him and he's like, does my breast smell? And he's like, yeah, it smells like dog shit. And he's like, I'm just kidding, dude, like whatever. So then the first Missy is who gets on the plane, so hence the wrong Missy,
right?
Because he was he had them both saved in his phone as Missy, and he was texting the wrong one. So there's this really awkward scene where she gives him a hand job on the plane and it apparently lasted because she dopes him with like Dramamine and like she gives him like a 1 hour like hand job and there's all these jokes about that. And then they get to Hawaii and it turns out that his ex is there with her new husband or new boyfriend because he works for the company. And so David Spade, like the girl that he met on in the airport, is a former Miss Maryland of all things. So he's like hyped her up, and there's this guy who's his best friend who works in HR that's constantly like reading his emails and looking at his browsing history. And so he's like hyped up this girl that he's bringing as like this beautiful whatever model, like, and it turns out that it's Missy and she's, you know, rambunctious and gregarious, but she kind of like through her like exuberance and outgoingness like makes him more popular with people, including the boss, who ends up offering him like this big promotion. Because Missy hypnotizes him into thinking that David Spade is like some kind of like fantastic person or something. But he eventually like gets a text from the other Missy and he texts her back like, oh my God, let me tell you what happened. I invited this like crazy woman. I don't even like her. But then over the course of the time they're together, like he really develops feelings for the wrong Missy, because of her good nature and that she brings out like this like excitement in him that he hasn't had before, of course. But then she reads the texts and she realizes that, you know, he like was saying mean things about her. So she leaves. And when she leaves, he realizes, like, oh, my God, I miss her. So now the wrong Missy is there with him. And he ends up getting drunk. And she's like, I thought you didn't drink. And he's like, I don't drink. But he's, like, doing shots. And then he ends up walking on his hands and falling off a balcony and breaking his leg again. And it fast forward, like, a couple months. And the other Missy, the Laura Lepkus, is in a bar. And Vanilla Ice is there. And her and Vanilla Ice are going to fuck. And then David Spade's like, no, no. Like, I pranked you. And she doesn't want anything to do with him. But then, like, 2 minutes later, they're, like, reigniting their relationship. And they end up together because she makes him a better person. And then, you know, they have love. So
does she?
I don't know. Does anything? It's like, he's still just an asshole. He's just, like, an asshole that drinks now. and he like gets fired
the best
from his
kind
job.
Of asshole.
He gets fired from his job because he breaks the hypnotism spell or whatever, and the boss realizes he doesn't really like him, so they let him go. And here's the thing, like, I didn't laugh once during this entire movie, which is a pretty common theme with like modern comedies and me. But I really enjoyed Laura Lepkus's performance in it. Like, I thought that she was the only thing worth watching in the whole movie. So every scene that she's in is generally kind of engaging, and like you really come to appreciate her, like her character. And everybody else is just terrible. Sarah Chalk is in it as the ex girlfriend. She fulfilling no real role and not really adding anything.
Seems up
and
her then, alley.
Whatever. I mean, she's just like whatever. And then Molly Sims is Jackie Sandler, this actress, is this character known as the Barracuda that like was up for the same job as Spade. And then finds out about like the wrong Missy. So she's the one that like gets him in contact again and wants to like take Spade's job. Then she kind of just like disappears. Molly Sims is the other Missy, the right Missy. There's some really weird shit with Rob Schneider, of course, is in it. Playing a what are those things called? Like a deep sea fishing boat captain. That's just there to do a weird accent and like set up a couple of jokes. I mean, it's just it's a really like tepid movie, and there's some like grotesque like sex jokes in it. The wrong Missy basically rapes David Spade the first night they're together. Cause he's unconscious. Like she knocks him out with a drug again, I think, or something. And then she's like having sex with him when he like comes to, and I don't know.
Just listening to some of the plot of this, not like that I think it is a theme, I would say, but some of the details you've given, do you feel that there is like some sort of almost like shoe on the other foot anti-cancel culture, like, you know, there, you know, not all guys type attitude behind some of this?
I don't really care that much, and I don't want to like, I haven't given it that much thought. I think it's just meant to be like a fish out of water comedy. Back to like one of our previous categories that you forced me into fucking doing in the regular podcast.
Christ, Frank, hold a grudge. Why don't you? Fucking 6 years.
Anytime you make me watch a comedy, it's going to stick in my head.
They were your top five comedies, but okay, never mind. Go ahead.
I know. Well, I mean, whatever.
And you liked all of them.
Yeah. Still to watch them. I don't know. I guess maybe there's some of that, like, we should just let people be who they are kind of thing. Because that's always in, like, the background of a Sandler movie is that, well, you know what? I want to save this commentary for the next movie because it's a lot more prevalent there.
Okay.
So I will say that, yes, you're right. That is, like, kind of what it is, but it's much more subdued here, kind of, even though, like, she's ridiculous. And they put her in a bunch of ridiculous, embarrassing situations. Just to kind of like build your compassion for her.
Yeah.
But again, like, I really think that the compassion is there anyway, because she's the only good performance in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like the entire time you're watching it, the only thing that I engaged with was her. Yeah. And I was like rooting for her to like leave him and find someone else at the end. Like I didn't want him to succeed, but I think the whole thing is you're supposed to engage with his like quote unquote growth as a character.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I don't know much about her. I tried to look. I don't think I've seen her in anything. And if I have, it's like a really, really bit role, maybe. But her more popular things that she's been in, I've never seen.
She's on some television show.
Yeah, Crashing, something that was on HBO. And but yeah, I'm not really familiar with her. But I mean, she's UCB alum, so
She actually is still active in UCB, I think.
So
I would never recommend this movie, but if you're stuck watching it for some reason, it's worth watching it for her. I'll just say that.
Mm-hmm.
So
silver
then,
silver lining. All right.
Yeah, it's it is a silver lining. So then, I had to watch another fucking Sandler movie. So, as much as I will always tell you that I dislike comedies, I do tend to watch them once in a while just because, like, it's just easy, I guess, to, like, sit down and put one on. Even though I'll usually opt for a horror movie in that instance. But, you know, sometimes I'll pick a comedy. So I had to find a Sandler movie I'd never seen. So I went with 2016's The Do-Over, directed by Stephen Brill, also starring David Spade, as essentially the same exact character.
Same writers, too, I think, just so you know.
So Spade plays this dude who's like, he's a manager of a bank that's inside a Save and Pay. So there's a constant running joke that people say that he works at the Save and Pay, and he gets all upset saying, no, I'm the manager of the bank inside the Save and Pay. Like, that joke literally happens like 14 times in the fucking movie. He's married to this girl he was obsessed with in high school, who was the prom queen. She divorced the prom king, but it's like heavily implied that they're still fucking, like, on the side. They have a loveless marriage where he basically supports her and her two awful teenage sons, who play pranks on him. And they do this thing, and I feel like I've seen this in a movie. They punch him in the stomach and then spray his pants with a super soaker and say that he pissed himself.
Is that a Billy Madison joke?
Maybe. I don't know.
The kids come up and one of the kids, like when he's in like elementary school, still come up and do that to him or something? Or is that the
Burp? No, in Billy Madison, there's the kid that actually pisses his pants.
Yeah, maybe that's it. There's a comedy where that happens, but it's a child that does it.
He pours liquid on his pants and he's like, hey, I pissed my pants.
Right, too. Yeah.
Like, that's what all the cool kids are doing to make the kid feel better about himself. Billy Madison is head and shoulders a far more engaging character than anything happening in the fucking Do-Over. So they're at their high school reunion, and Spade is reconnected with his high school best friend, Max, who is known as Maxi Pad, who's Adam Sandler, who tells them he achieved his dream of joining the FBI, and he's living this like exciting life now. And he shows him a gun and like a ankle holster, and shows him his FBI badge. And then there's this mysterious woman that's like tracking him, and he's like, oh, she's crazy, but I just gave her my hotel key because got to give him the carrot sometimes. I don't know, whatever. So his Spade's wife wins this all-inclusive weekend to some resort in Florida that she decides she's going to take her best friend on because it's the spa getaway. And like, obviously she can't take a man with her on the spa getaway, but he can stay and take care of the house. And Max has offered like, hey, you know, anytime you want to come hang out, like come hang out with me. So Spade, who gets like super annoyed that his wife abandoned him and treats him like shit, decides that, yeah, I'm going to go on this vacation. So he goes down and he goes to Florida, and it turns out Max has like this yacht, kind of like one of those smaller like yachts. And they go out on this adventure where they're smoking weed and getting women in like boats to flash them and, you know, enjoying themselves. And the biggest trend in this movie is gay humor. Like, it's always implied that someone's a homosexual, and it gets much worse, and we'll get to that. But that's like the common thread. Like, they're basically like 15-year-old boys like hanging out with each other. So Spade gets high and drunk one night and passes out, and he wakes up and they're in like a dinghy, like a lifeboat, and the yacht explodes. So Sandler reveals that he was never in the FBI, that he's in all this debt, and that he faked his death in order to start a new life. Like, he wants to get away from his previous life. So he has these ideas of these two men, Butch and, Dr. Ronald something.
No, I saw Dr. Ronald Fishman. Fishman, yeah.
Ronald Fishman. Who's presumably Jewish. That's another joke. So they go to Puerto Rico because Fishman had a... Oh, Jesus. So there's another joke that repeats. Fishman had a... Sandler gives Spade a P.O. box key, and Spade, with his bank manager knowledge, starts talking about how P.O. boxes work. Not P.O. box, safety deposit box. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And then Sandler's like, smell it. And he's like, yeah, it was up his ass. And so there's constantly jokes about David Spade, like, being put in a situation where something disgusting is done to him, unbeknownst to him, until he finds out. And then, like, you're like, ah, it's so gross. Haha. Except I didn't laugh at this movie either. So they go to Puerto Rico to find the safety deposit box. And it turns out it's full of like $1 million and all these documents. And so they start hanging out in Puerto Rico. The Fishman and Butch had bought like this giant mansion. So they're like having parties at the mansion. And then they meet their neighbor, who's this like buxom, like middle-aged brunette. And David Spade wants to fuck her. So they go to this club, and Luis Guzman is there, and he's the shooter guy. So he's like pouring shots, and they're talking, and Sandler's like, well, what do you want to do? Like, what's your fantasy? He's like, oh, I really want to have a threesome, like talking about, because the brunette brings out her blonde friend. Mm-hmm. So then it cuts to a scene where David Spade and Luis Guzman are running a train on the brunette.
Jesus.
Sandler is sitting on the couch with the blonde who's passed out, like kind of directing things. And Spade's like, this is not the kind of threesome I wanted. And Sandler's like, we'll just go with it. So then they decide to trade spaces. And so Spade lays down and the brunette gets on top of him. And then Luis Guzman comes back out. So there's a bit where Luis Guzman is standing naked over David Spade and his balls are hanging down over David Spade's face. And he's talking about how hot it is and his balls are sweating. And then they cut to a scene of like sweat running off of his like testicles and falling on David Spade's face.
Okay.
And then the next morning, like, they have breakfast and Adam Sandler makes some scrambled eggs and like a giant sausage. So there's a bunch of other jokes about David Spade, like what he did with the sausage. And yeah, I never want to talk about it again. And Adam Sandler, like, keep pushing anyway.
So evolved humor. Gotcha. Okay.
Right. So then it turns out that there's, of course, like bad guys that are coming after the two people that whose identities they assume. Mm-hmm. So you have some scenes where, the whole movie is intermittently narrated by David Spade, like telling the story of this adventure. So it'll like pause. It'll do the thing where it pauses and David Spade will speak over it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
so how did I end up in this situation type?
Right, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. I guess you're wondering how we got here.
Right.
Well, it turns out that Max, blah, blah, blah. So David Spade is floating in a pool, like making a sandwich. And this guy comes over because the brunette was married. So the guy's like threatening David Spade. And then some people come in and start shooting. So David Spade has to like swim underwater and he's dodging bullets underwater somehow. And Adam Sandler comes out and he's wearing like a tactical vest, and David Spade, like, it pauses. David Spade's like, this is when I found out that Max may not have been in the FBI, but he was really Action Jackson. And so then Adam Sandler like murders these people, except for this one guy who's this tall German who's like a gymnast. He's doing like flips and stuff, so he gets away. Then they introduce this other character that just ends up getting hit by the Ferrari that they have that they escape in. So it turns out that Fishman was married to this like beautiful Puerto Rican woman. So they go to find her because they're trying to figure out like why are people after them, and they end up hitting her with an RV, and she's like barely injured. So they tend to her wounds, and Adam Sandler's like they end up taking her to this like bar. They reveal that they've assumed the identities and that the Fishman and Butch are dead. and she's all upset, but then she starts to like kind of like David Spade. And they go to this bar, and there's this big biker guy who, so one of the things that they did, oh Jesus, I forgot about this fucking bit. They decided if they were going to imitate Butch and Ron, that they had to like, they had to get their tattoos and stuff. So Butch had all these tattoos, including like there was a letter from a Dakota. It was like, I love you so much. Like, you sexy, whatever. Love, Dakota. So he gets Dakota tramp stamp on his back and gets like all these like tattoos. And David's, the only thing that Fishman had was a tongue ring. So David Spade gets his tongue pierced with like a, what are those, the dumbbell or whatever.
Yeah.
So they go to this bar and this big biker like grips up Sandler and is like, what'd you do to Butch? And Sandler's like, I didn't do anything. And Fishman's wife comes over and they explain the situation. And it turns out that the biker and Butch were like gay lovers, and they make all these like gay jokes there. And Adam Sandler, Butch is like, hey, why don't you stay with me? Like, I'll keep you safe. And Adam Sandler's like, you know, I really appreciate it, but like, I'm, you know, I'm not that kind of guy. But let me give you something to jerk off to later. So then Adam Sandler blows his fingers and like mimes like,
Jesus, you know, Christ.
Yeah. Ugh. And Butch is outside like getting off on it. And then you find out that Ronald Fishman was gay too and was Butch's lover. And that the tongue ring that he has was not a tongue ring, but it was a cock stud. So then David Spade has a bit where he's got to try and like wrench this like fucking like cock ring out of his tongue. And then they have a joke where it was better in your tongue than in his cock. And like, ha ha ha. So then the gymnast comes back, so they escape and they hit the guy that was introduced before again. And you find out that that guy was actually is a fraud agent for American Express. And Adam Sandler gives him $150,000 in cash and says, you know, just say that you recovered it and spend the rest on whatever you want. So then the plot becomes that, oh, so they go to visit Adam Sandler's mom. And it turns out that David Spade, like, saw his mom in the shower when he was young, and that was the first, like, pair of boobs he saw. But the mom may have purposefully showed him her boobs. I don't know. That's some weird, like, other subplot. But she's got Alzheimer's. So there's a bunch of Alzheimer's jokes. Then the woman from the beginning, like, the one that was, like, stalking Adam Sandler, she comes back and they have like really loud sex while David Spade and Fishman's wife are sitting in a bedroom listening. And then they end up having sex and they're like in love now. And then you find out that what Fishman and Butch were doing was they had developed like a non-invasive cure for cancer that basically eliminated chemotherapy through targeting cells with like MRIs or I don't know. They explained it was some like fucking pseudoscience.
Okay.
So the people that are after him are actually like representatives of the largest like chemo manufacturer in the world, and that's why they wanted to
okay
kill him, because they want to keep people on chemotherapy. And
okay,
then you find out that so then they go and break into the office to figure out we got to find like this formula for this drug. And so there's all this shit. And David Spade turns out that he can hack things because that's what you do in the bank. And Adam Sandler and him getting this like argument because Spade implies that Sandler's only in it for the money and he takes umbrage. And then Spade finds out looking through the files that Sandler was one of the people that was part of their clinical trials where they were finding like really great success in eliminating cancer. And that's the reason why Sandler like is so hellbent on trying to like figure out what happened to Butch and Fishman. So of course, like the Puerto Rican lady, Mrs. Fishman, she's like the actual bad guy, and she was like tired of like living with a gay man, so she was paid to. She like took their money to like give up the formula, and murdered them.
What? Okay.
And then Spade figures out that, because she says, like, I, or no, so Spade goes to after he figures out that Max was like has cancer, he goes to talk to Max's wife, and she's like, "Yeah, you know, like we knew Fishman and Butch." So, like, anyway, doesn't matter. And they came out of the lab one time, and I could tell they were doing something hot and heavy, and they said they were playing Jenga. So then Spade realizes that Jenga is an app on this tablet that they found, and that's where, like, the formula is. But Max has been kidnapped by the German, like, gymnast assassin, and has this thing where he's going to lube up, like, this dildo and stick it up Adam Sandler's ass. So there's this, like, three-minute bit where Adam Sandler's like, you know, this makes you gay if you do this. And the German's like, nah, it's not gay. And he's like, well, you're going to, like, put something in my ass, right? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, and you're going to enjoy it, right? And he's like, yeah, I am. And he's like, well, you know, I mean, no offense, and I don't think there's anything wrong with this, but it makes you gay. So this is, like, what you were talking about. And this is a problem with, like, most of Adam Sandler's movies, where the joke is meant to make you laugh at someone for being, like, a homosexual or whatever. Because it's always, like, a homosexual joke.
Right.
You're supposed to laugh at the fact and be like, ew, like, that's disgusting. Mm-hmm. While Adam Sandler is virtue signaling on your screen by saying, right, like, oh, no, there's nothing wrong with
this. Like, 20-year-old Seinfeld joke, right? Yeah.
Right, but you're, like, you're laughing at the fact that Adam Sandler is about to get sodomized. So,
right. David and that's why I'm reacting the way that I am, is because it's really, like, this, like, grotesque homophobic comedy that is masquerading under the idea of, like, oh, we're just telling jokes.
Right, and then trying to make it so it's about, like, curing cancer.
Right.
To further, like, put themselves on the side of right. Anyway, so the German ends up, like, electrocuting himself because he's, like, tweaking his nipples with some C-clamps that are attached to a battery, and then liquid spills all over the floor, and he dies.
Right.
The German, and Sandler escapes, and Spade has figured out that Mrs. Fishman is, like, the bad guy, and so they get in a fist fight, and Spade, like, beats her up for a while, but then she gets the upper hand, and then Max shows up, and he kind of saves Spade for a little bit, but then the woman is still, like, beating the or she has a gun, and she's gonna kill him, and then Max's wife shows up, and ends up, like, they get in this big, long fight. Fuck, I can't remember which song it's to, but it goes on for a really long time. And the end result is, like, they beat up Mrs. Fishman, but the tablet gets, like, thrown in the water by accident because they're on, like, the pier in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was the Amex agent who got the shit kicked out of him was actually an FBI agent. So then they're going to arrest Max and David Spade, and the tablet's gone, so they don't even have, like, the cure anymore. But it turns out that David Spade put, like, copied the cure onto a USB and then stuck it up his ass. Right. To bring you full circle to the beginning of the movie. And so they use the leverage of having, like, the cure for cancer to get out of going to jail. And then they're all, like, living in the mansion in Puerto Rico together. And Adam Sandler's mom comes, and she's not wearing a top, but of course she's, like, 70. So she's got these, like, super saggy, like, breasts. And she's, like, waving him around, and she's, like, asking David Spade if they still look good to him. And then Luis Guzman comes in, and he says, like, they may be worn, but they still taste great or something. And
God.
Yeah. And then that's the end. I mean, you know, the movie ends with them, like, jumping off this cliff together because that's what David Spade always wanted to do but was afraid to do, and so implying. Oh, and he also goes back home and, because they fake their deaths, so, you know, there's, like, a funeral and everything, and his ex-wife is now, like, openly living with her ex-husband and, like, fucking him, which, whatever. I don't even understand why they got divorced. I guess the scheme was they would get divorced so she could marry Spade so he could pay for everything and they could continue to, like, sleep together or whatever. But there's also a scene where David Spade is, like, tries to go back home after they fake their deaths, so, because he feels, like, guilty, and sees his two, like, stepsons masturbating in bed, and can't talk to them, and then goes in and sees his wife is pegging the ex-husband, like, she's behind him and, like,
okay,
fucking him in the ass, yeah, while they watch the Dolphins game.
So it's more homophobic humor.
Yeah. It's just, that's all everything is. So then he comes back and he dresses up like a zombie and he scares everybody.
What?
David Spade, yeah, because that's how he like gets his revenge on them for treating him so poorly. And that's the end of the movie.
So, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I got like some like third hand chagrin or something like off of just listening to that. Fuck.
Well, it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
So you're welcome.
I mean, everything Sandler does now is on Netflix. I mean, I'm going to just say this. I think that I said it to you off air, but maybe I didn't. Like, to some degree, it's like, I get it. Like, you're trying to find, like, to some degree, like, the chagrin here. You could always save yourself in some small ways, and you don't. So, I mean, kudos to you in one way. And then, like, in other ways, it's like, man. Like, you could have just done, like, a fucking, whatever those movies, a mystery movie or whatever the fuck it's called. Like, or Who Be Halloween or some shit. Or, like, you know, some Sandler-related bullshit. Spaceman. Like,
No, actually, I think that might not be too bad overall.
That's what I'm saying. Know, you can watch it, and maybe it's a low chagrin movie. Like,
that doesn't meet the specifications.
What?
You gotta
be shocked by.
you gotta try to find something. I either gotta find something that I think will cause me chagrin, or something where I feel like I have a chance to be pleasantly surprised. But not something that's just going to be like super boring and that I won't care about. Which I think most of the like low effort Adam Sandler movies would be.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Whatever. We're trying to make.
I'm not trying to make anything. I'm saying
I'm trying to make for like entertaining, you know, podcasting. Ain't nobody gonna care if I'm watching some normal ass movie.
Well, middle of the road, like,
yeah,
Netflix.
May as well listen to the regular podcast.
Yeah.
What's our most downloaded episode? It's The Farm, and that was a lot of chagrin. So.
Right. Right. Yeah, I will never understand it, but yes, yeah, she's true. Yeah,
so this is a pretty high chagrin. It's like a 9.
Yeah.
Like, there's really nothing worth mentioning or redeeming in this movie. Like, it's just pretty awful from start to finish. I don't know who's laughing at this movie, but I don't think I want to talk to them. So if anyone listens to this podcast and has enjoyed the do-over, please do not ever let me know that that's the case, because I don't know what I'll say to you, but probably not be very nice. The Wrong Missy is like a 6, I guess. I mean, there's still some terrible things. And I also didn't laugh at it, but Lapkus's performance is 100% like saves that movie.
Yeah.
To the point where it's like almost worth watching at that point. So.
Yeah, I don't think these guys, I tried to look up on IMDb and I started getting confused by like all their different roles of producer and writer and all this shit. But I think this is the only two movies that they actually like wrote like as a team, this Kevin Barnett and Chris Pappas. Although they're both oddly enough staff writers on The Righteous Gemstones, which is a show that I enjoy 85% of the time. Overall, but that could be performances or they're in a writer's room and are getting restrained from some of their more grotesque, obviously, like, you know, instincts as writers. But all of these people are Sandler-verse people or whatever, Happy Madison people, like it's
a
universe, you know.
It's one of the things that it makes it really difficult to hate Adam Sandler, even though like I find most of his movies to be repulsive and not funny at all. But he's definitely a guy that like is just trying to look out for people that he likes, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's a guy that achieved success at a really early age and has never forgotten the people that he came up with, you know?
Yeah. Agreed.
Like, you ain't going to see Rob Schneider in any fucking movie, but you're going to see him in an Adam Sandler movie.
Sure.
And David Spade ain't getting work nowhere, but David Spade is
Well, he does have, he's had a late night show on Comedy Central for years. But, like, in terms of movie, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. But at the same, so he's like around, he's always like kind of ever present Spade in some small, unnotable way. But it's, I think it's largely because he can just pop people like in his private life all the time, like with that snarky wit and stuff. And so he just kind of gets like kept around. And, but I'll be honest, like, maybe I have the wrong impression of David Spade as a human being. How has this guy not gotten canceled yet?
Because I think he's liberal enough that nobody wants to cancel him because they don't want to lose. Like, I understand that it's like really, there is really uncomfortable, like a lot of his comments. But that's the part that appeals to whatever, I don't know, like the less sensitive like viewer, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, look, the guy can be funny, and he always has been able to be funny. Like, he has some good shit at times. He has good jokes. But what I imagine Spade is like in his personal life is always like not, I haven't been able to reconcile that with like the idea of him not to some degree. And like I said, maybe I had the wrong impression of the dude, but like it feels like there's like two or three things potentially like inside of there, like, you know, that could lead him to like not being around anymore. But maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. I mean, I guess just sometimes people get a pass, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's not a sex pest. Like I said, he's a guy that generally,
but like, I'm shocked by that to some degree. Right.
Yeah, but in his real life, he's like, when you watch interviews with Adam Sandler.
Well, Sandler's different from Spade. I'm talking about Spade here.
Oh, like, Spade, right. Yeah, I don't.
Oh, no, Sandler's cool. Like, Sandler is like a really nice, humble, fucking super humble and thoughtful guy. Like, I mean, I have no problems with Adam Sandler, despite some of his shitty comedies. But, and his older comedies, we've talked about them over the past 2 years on the podcast, when I forced you to do comedy episodes. And,
yeah, because I really like Happy Gilmore still.
Yeah.
And I think Billy Madison is a funny movie.
Sure, and The Wedding Singer is a good movie.
Yeah, I love The Wedding Singer.
Yeah, like,
I actually even have a little bit of affection for Mr. Deeds, even though I don't think it's a good movie.
Sure.
Like, there's still, like, a few Mr. Deeds.
And that, I really think it's as bland as it kind of can be. I think 51st Dates is a good movie. I think him and Barrymore make for a good pairing on screen for those two movies that they do together. Like, so, yeah, I mean, he has some good stuff, and especially in the 90s, but I guess, like you said, like, I mean, he's just looking out for people, you know,
like, That's My Boy is the same it's all the same fucking humor, and it's all uncomfortable and weird, but it's very specific to, some people just love it, you know, like, some people are really into like that very base and crass humor. And I guess that part of it is the idea that you can like present some positive message that's couched in like the most terrible joke, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like these movies don't get made though. Like, that this is a 2010s thing, and like that these movies have moved away a little bit from that, probably. Like, comedies in general have like started to move away from that a little bit.
Well, you know, I mean, they're still making like fucking, that's the thing is, like, how do you argue against like a Daddy Daycare box office, you know? Like, it doesn't cost him any money to make.
Sure.
He just calls up Kevin James and fucking Spade and whoever else is in there. It's like, hey, come on. And, you know, gets them for like a discount, and it doesn't matter.
I don't know. Yeah. I just mean the humor aspect feels like it's moved away a little bit from some of this stuff of the 2010s. Like, even watching what, I've already forgotten the name of that movie, the one with Cena that I watched and told you about on Prime.
Oh, Ricky Stenicki?
Yes. How do I forget that name? But, it had some shit in there, but, like, you know, that was, like, okay, like, this, but it was based on stereotypes more than it was based on, like, making, like, pointed specific jokes to lessen people and punch down. So I think even, like, some of these more, like Fairly Brothers type shit, like, this type of shit with Happy Madison, I feel like they're moving away from some of that, like, you know, punching down, like, let's make fun of specific groups type thing a little bit more as we get to the modern day, I guess. This was that's a very 2010s movie. Like, that's My Boy was 2012 or something, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, like, it feels like that decade, like, there was these, like, holdovers of movies like this, and I think we're moving away a little bit from it. Like,
so let me counteract your statement there by telling you that I just opened up Freevee.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always want to anticipate, like, the category so I can start looking right away.
Uh-huh.
And the number one and number two free movies on Freebie this week are Grown Ups and Grown Ups 2.
Interesting. But does that have the exact type of humor of something like this, though?
I think it's pretty goddamn close, yeah.
Yeah? I've never seen any of them.
I think it's dick jokes and implied homosexual jokes. Because that's the whole point, is that they're best friends from school that are, like, learning to cope with, like, the realities of whatever, like,
right,
adulthood. And they're all in a state of arrested development. I mean, that's always the...
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. All right, speaking of which, you want to see what you get next week?
Yeah, hit me.
Category for next week is they were trying to be tongue-in-cheek, but it's all tongue. They were trying to be tongue-in-cheek, but it's all tongue.
It's a good line. I'm over here popping for myself.
It is a good line. Find this category, so I can delete it and don't forget while I'm right there.
I have no fucking idea. I don't right. even know.
Yeah. Still seems wide open. I mean, you could do.
No, I don't. I'll work it out. I don't like to bury the lead, you know. I just want to.
You want to sit on it a little bit.
Yeah, I want you to be surprised.
Ruminate, like, let it marinate a little bit. Find something.
Actually, it could have been the do-over because the scene where David Spade gets
that's right. Here. That's yeah. right. You know, there were three other categories on the wheel this year that movie could also fit. I was thinking awesome. Of them as you were. As you were talking.
Yeah. Too bad I already fucking watched it.
Yeah. No, you just find something else. I'll find that later. So, is there anything you want to talk about, Frank?
No.
All right, then. So, we always talk about this stuff only in kind of like covert or oblique ways a lot of times, usually like to pop ourselves more than anything, but as a follow-up to this weekend's primary feed podcast of No Holds Barred, I wanted to actually talk to you about like WrestleMania this weekend, since that was kind of in honor of WrestleMania. What were your we were somebody that we, just so people know, we've been watching wrestling generally again since 2016. Is that correct?
I think that's right. 15 or 16.
Yeah. after years of like not watching it, like 15 years, like pretty much for me. Overall, like since like I guess the Attitude Era, with a couple times I would check out stuff, but so yeah, I mean, like a lot of things have happened in the past like year, in like a few years, I guess, in professional wrestling. 2 years, yeah. 4 years if you count like, you know, a competitor, I suppose, but like trying to like spur things along in a different direction. But just sticking with WrestleMania, last year I have never seen Frank as disappointed in like a movie, like a TV show, I think, like or in something that has story like wrestling, than I was last year when I saw Cody Rhodes did not win the world title almost a year ago to the day. And
heartbreaking.
Yeah. I was kind of stunned by it, but like at the same time, like, I don't know, like we have different attitudes. Like I think that somehow you've become, so can I ask you this? Like, I think you're really emotionally invested in the story of Cody Rhodes in some way.
And... No, I like positive things in my life. Like I like things to have good endings, I guess. And yeah, I was really invested in Cody Rhodes because I think it's a good character. And
yeah, but I actually want to ask you, like, you know, what is it about Cody that you think connects in some way?
I think he's the first babyface wrestler in, God, I don't even know what the last one would be, like, real, like, legitimate white meat babyface that still feels relevant and important, and like that you want to see what he's doing, and like, you know, you want to see him succeed. So I think that's really like impressive that guy has that ability to connect all over the place with, like, you know, like diehard fans, new fans, young people, old people. Like, even I think unless you're so cynical that you're just dead inside, I think it's difficult to not like enjoy watching that guy be successful.
Right.
And as much as I hated watching him lose last year, like, it really made it so satisfying to watch him succeed this year.
Sure.
And because, like, the brilliance of it is that they put you in a position where you legitimately thought that there was a chance that he could lose again. Like, it made the actual event itself feel, like, vital and important, and that there were stakes to it.
Yes.
As opposed to just watching, like, people fake fight each other, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to, like, emotionally, I don't know why I have to anymore, but it's like I have to emotionally distance myself largely from professional wrestling, and I look at it like in this kind of like more like objective, like cynical way.
It's because you don't like to feel things. I don't know.
I mean, you're not incorrect. I mean, like, even in that glibness, but I mean, like, but no, it was completely satisfying. Even looking at it from that perspective, like, you know, it's still extremely interesting because, like you said, like, it puts doubt in people's minds. And I think they did just enough. And I was fairly confident Cody was going to win, but there was just enough doubt in my mind as, like, this kind of cynical, impartial, like, almost observer to some degree, that's like just looking at, like, how, because that's what I find fascinating about wrestling, watching it anymore, is how it works. And I told somebody the other week, somebody as a, like, kind of as a joke, it's like, you know, it's basically like, you know, the trauma Marcus, I think I told him trauma Marcus, I was drunk, trauma Marcus Aurelius in wrestling is like basically is like what made me, like, you know, to some degree what I am. And like, I think I've learned a lot throughout my life in professional wrestling in a lot of different ways. And I really find it interesting about how you sell, basically. I don't mean like sell, like as a shoot term, like in the ring or whatever. I just like mean like promote and like, you know, and then plan and try to get reactions out of people. Like, I find all that shit fascinating. And I think from the regard of how they've handled this, like, even if you're not looking at it from an emotional standpoint, which I understand exists and I can see it and I understand it, I think just the idea of like booking it to where it's like there's the possibility this guy can lose again, and they make you believe that he could lose again, and convince me, who's completely cynical and thinks like, well, of course they're going to put it on Cody, make me believe that like that's a possibility that they won't, and there's like another twist or turn that they can take, is super fucking impressive, because I haven't felt that way since I was a child, I think.
And so I actually have an explanation for why it works so well, I think.
Yeah.
That I was thinking about. Mm-hmm. You look back at like the previous like babyface champions, like true babyface.
Yeah.
So before this was probably like 2000 Cena.
Right.
Was like the same time they tried to do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Goldberg,
yeah, I mean
Hogan, I guess, before that. And it eventually gets tiresome.
Sting as well. I mean, Sting, I know you weren't watching really as much back then, but yeah, Sting as well.
Because, well, and Sting works, and Sting has retained his popularity because it's the same thing they do with Cody. Goldberg never lost a match, right, until the point where, like, you were actively rooting for Goldberg to lose a match.
Yes.
Cena went over everybody, because to the point where you would actively root for Cena to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Cody Rhodes takes losses all the time.
Sure.
Like, Cody Rhodes has lost many times.
Took a loss on fucking night one of WrestleMania before he won.
And took the pin.
Yes.
And Cody Rhodes comes up short, just barely, like by a fingertip. And usually not through his own mistake, but sometimes through his own arrogance or his own like naivete, I guess, is kind of mm-hmm. like how they sell it. To the point where you know he can do it, but they keep letting him not do it. So because they build him as like flawed and fallible, when he overcomes it, that's so much more satisfying than seeing the guy that, like, even no matter how much you have seen a struggle against like an opponent, you know that at the end he's going to come out on top.
Right.
It was the thing that ruined Roman Reigns before they turned him into mm-hmm. a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
That you always knew that Roman was going to like find a way to win.
Yeah.
And it just made him so uninteresting. But the fact that Cody, that you have that pathos of the idea that even though he's your guy, it's what draws people into like actual sports. And right. It's brilliant to do it in the sense of like a fake
sports.
Because, you know, you love your team of choice because you want to see them succeed, but it gives you the tension of knowing that they might not be able to, mm-hmm. you know, like it like pulls at your heart to like watch your team lose, because you're so invested in seeing them win. But if your team wins all the time, that's why I have no respect for people who are like Patriots fans or Chiefs fans, unless they've been those things for, you know, their entire lives. But like sure. people that like are bandwagon jumpers, you just don't want to feel hurt. You know, you just don't want to feel pain. Like, that's weak.
Right.
It's the reason why like I love horror movies, right? Like, I want to feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
For the catharsis of like getting that out in a way that's not my real life,
right?
You know?
Right.
And that's what Cody does for you, is
sure.
And they're doing a great yeah. job with like a lot of people in that respect, I think, too. Like,
and I think I will say, just to follow up on your pain statement, like, I mean, I think that like it's pretty apt, like with the analysis of like bandwagon jumpers to some degree. And I have a lot of reasons why I don't like to feel things, but I mean, like, as a sports fan growing up as a child, like, I mean, I was like super into like certain teams and stuff like that. Like, and I felt that fucking pain. And I think in part, like it combined at an age, seeing the Oilers lose to the Bills was one of the most heart-wrenching things I ever saw in my entire life, because I was a Houston Oilers fan growing up, for those, because we never talk sports really. But one of the more heart-wrenching things that I ever had. And you combine that with the other things that was going on in my life at that time. Like, I think, like, in some ways I had to, like, become more objective and, like, tuned out of, like, following a team in sports. And it became real easy when the Oilers moved to do that. And it's like, oh, that's not my team anymore. So, like, I just don't have to think about those kind of things. And I was able to distance myself. And I think it's the same kind of analogy, like, with professional wrestling. Like, you know, it's really hard for me to root for anybody in, like, really root for anybody in professional wrestling, because I'm so distanced from the, you know, kayfabe aspects from it. But it's been really hard for a long time, like, to do that under Vince McMahon's booking, you know. I mean, there's a reason you stop watching at some point, right? And sure, largely, and it all goes back to him. But
because when you can predict everything,
right?
And look, we like fantasy book all the time,
sure,
use like whatever, like the lingo of wrestling.
Yeah,
like we make up scenarios of this is what might happen, or wouldn't this be awesome, or this is what I think they're gonna do. And, like, you know, we talked about this, and we got a lot of things right about what was going to happen. But I really feel like they're in a position where they're really good now at building you to not know for sure what the outcome of something is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a concept in the modern WWE called the Money in the Bank, which is a annual pay-per-view where there's a briefcase suspended above the ring. And you have to use a ladder to climb up and grab the briefcase. And whoever does then has the ability to use that at any point to challenge someone for their title. So typically the way that it happens is that someone cashes that in after someone's like won like a really hard fought match, but is like beaten down and exhausted. And that person will use that opportunity to like wrestle them then and there and take their title away from them. So there's, and I know like you already know all this, Chris, but I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, yeah.
The uninitiated. There's a wrestler who
you're doing a better job than Tony Khan is of hooking those casuals. So
there's a wrestler that we're not a huge fan of that has been the holder of said briefcase for the past 8 or 9 months. And has never cashed it in. He's had a couple of failed attempts where something's happened that stopped him. And we had predicted that he would cash in on the winner of this, the first match of the evening of Sunday's WrestleMania, because it's a two-night event. And it didn't happen. And it was almost like, it almost popped me just as hard for him not to do it, because I had no idea what they were going to do, and to watch the guy that won like start to celebrate. And then they dragged it out, and then they had the guy come cash in. And that made me like even more excited for it, because they had led me to believe that it wasn't going to happen. So then when it did, it was like,
right.
Again, it's almost this cathartic feeling of like being right, and also of seeing this kind of exciting moment like play out before your
because
eyes.
Because it's not exactly what you could anticipate.
Right. And previously, under like the previous creative direction of WWE, it would have just happened immediately. Like, they would have played the music.
Right.
He would have run down. There would have been like a brief, like, minute long, like, back and forth. But then the challenger would have overcome and pinned the guy. And here, they like played it into a whole nother story that's going to continue on past, you know, this specific incident.
Yeah, yeah. And I think
sets up,
go ahead,
like, yeah, literally sure, like 3 or 4 different ways,
right,
that they can go, and yep, you don't know exactly, yep, what they're going to do, and it makes it exciting to see, like,
yeah. And I also feel that excitement to some degree, like, even removed, I can't remember where I stole it from, honestly, at this point, but I've been using it for years, like, to talk about, like, the idea of, like, flipping. I flip switches in my head, like, constantly, and, like, I'm, like, playing out all the outcomes, like, all the time things. And I do that with pro wrestling. Like, I'm assuming that's what you were like intimating a couple weeks ago that I thought was really funny is like when you said, you know, like sometimes to fall asleep, you have like fantasy book or something like that. Mm-hmm. And like, I kind of do something similar, like a lot of times where it's like, I flip the switches of like all the possibilities, because again, it's like almost like a, like playing like a DS, like mind puzzle game. Like, you know, for me, it's like, you know, can I guess like how this can play out, like based on like the evidence that's in front of me and stuff like that. And it's like, it's another way of thinking that I think I've learned from pro wrestling in some ways. Yeah. But I
and the thing that makes the thing that makes that effective and that really draws you in, it isn't the times you're wrong. And that's fine sometimes to be like wrong.
Yeah.
The times when you get it right and it's like what you consider to be the most awesome outcome.
Yes.
So, like, one of the things that I said last week, we were talking about WrestleMania, and not to spoil anything, although I'd imagine if you wanted to see WrestleMania at this point, is the idea that there was going to be, like, these stars from the past that were going to come out and help even the odds against, like, this, you know, the evil, like, villain champion who always is, like, cheating and using his minions to kind of help him win. And actually, that's what cost, you know, Cody the belt last year is this interference. And for years, they've booked these, you know, good guy wrestlers to be idiots and never have backup and never take into account that the bad guy's going to cheat. And so whenever they win, it's over like almost inconceivable odds that they're winning, you know, and they did it. Like, they did exactly almost to like beat for beat, like what I kind of said,
right?
I thought what should happen, it would be awesome. And instead of me feeling like, oh, well, you know, I predicted that one, it was such like a exciting moment to like see it play out, you know, like, because I think all of us like fantasize about things every day, like, you know, we play scenarios and how we want things to go.
Sure.
Most of the time you're disappointed because things don't go exactly how you anticipated. Or...
Yes, right.
And so, like, when you see something go almost exactly as you anticipated, it's so, like, energizing to watch. And it's just, I don't know, it's just, it's something that I, Paul Levesque, Triple H, the guy that's the head of WWE's creative right now, is just, like, hitting all these beats in such the right way.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up about like that anticipation, that flipping the switches type of thing, a fantasy booking. What it is so long we've been programmed, and this goes back 25 years. We started getting programmed, I think, because what do we like reminisce on, like as Xers, you know, type, like, you know, when we think about wrestling. There's some Attitude Era stuff, but a lot of it's the Hogan stuff, right? Like, you know, that's, you know, it's that period that we just like we're talking a little bit about, like on the primary feed, with Orion, is that like, you know, 87 to like, you know, 91 era kind of like, and we reminisce on those things because there was fucking 4 pay per views a year, right? So it's like what you could do at that point with 4 pay per views is you could long term book. Like, you could play things out and, like, have an idea for, okay, so in 4 months at this pay-per-view, we're going to do this thing and this thing. And what we got trained on in the 90s by both major promotions was the idea that it's, like, you're writing week to week on a show to pop ratings, and then you're writing to the next pay-per-view. And then you basically start over and write to that next pay-per-view. And if long-term storytelling takes place, it's kind of like maybe because it's building up to WrestleMania or in WCW 90 Starrcade, maybe. Like you're just maybe building to the main event of that like one pay-per-view. And we got trained on that. And I think what's happening now is they're much like a writer's room for like a TV show. I think there are long-term arcs that are being planned. And short term like writing that's happening to get to some of those arcs. And I think it's a radical shift. And like, I make fun of the idea of like finishing the story or tell me story, like all the time when I'm watching professional wrestling, like, you know, but the idea is like anymore, they really are telling you a story that they've thought out way in advance.
Right.
And I think that can be nothing but beneficial to the, like, you know, genre of professional wrestling by doing that. And I think Triple H, the Paul Levesque era of story, is actually a really positive thing, ultimately, for people that follow that stuff.
Yeah, and it puts you in a position where you're, like, because you're uncertain of what's going to happen, but you can see so many different scenarios play out in your head, like, it makes you want to watch. It makes it like, I hate the terms like can't miss television, but it definitely makes it something that every single week, you know, I will catch up on it and make sure that I'm up to speed on what's going on and watch like highlights and,
right,
you know, parts of matches or whole matches if I'm able. I don't know. It's just
Agreed. I mean, yeah, I think it creates, and it goes by having long-term storytelling, kind of like this Cody thing, to kind of like bring it back around. Without even getting into The Rock, but it's like The Rock coming back is like a major damn thing in professional wrestling. Like overall, like, because it gets eyes on the product, I think, like from a promotional standpoint, but that story that they've told in the past couple, like, few months, even if it was, like, kind of, like, a little bit of it was done on the fly, as, like, the final chapter to Cody, like, doing this, like, what it does is it creates, it's what people grew up on in, like, the 70s and the 80s, or even going back further than that, maybe, is you have these long-term stories, and it creates myth. And that's, like, what, it, like, I mean, because I think Orion said it the other night or something, or maybe Orion's friend like said something about it being like a male soap opera. It absolutely is, right? Sure. Like, you know, and not even to gender it that way, because I know there's women that watch, but like, what, when we grew up, it's like these people were like mythical figures,
right?
And that got lost in some way, and by telling these long stories, like, Roman Reigns became, like, to some degree, as much as I, like, disliked what was being done with him 10 years ago, like, Roman Reigns, like, in that title reign of, like, so long, like, of nearly, like, what, beginning of the pandemic, right? Like, you know, I mean, like, it's four years almost, you know, yeah. Is, like, myth. Like, he's, like, this mythical figure now. Like, rebranding him the tribal chief, like, with all this pomp and circumstance, like, you know, that title reign has become like part of the mythology of professional wrestling, where it's like, I don't know if you can say that, like, about, like, and like a lot of things that have happened so much in the past 20 years of that sport, you know, like, of fake fighting. But it's really damn exciting, I guess, like, you know, to be able to have that again, like, you know, and kind of see that play out. Like, and I just also, the last thing I guess I want to say about anything involving wrestling is I shit on Dwayne a lot all the time as a joke, but rightfully so. But Rocky's been real damn good in this role that he's played in the past couple months in WWE. Maybe like one of my favorite like Rocky things ever, regardless of movie, professional wrestling, anything. Like, that guy's hitting like on all cylinders like right now.
Yeah, I agree.
There was one last small thing I was going to ask you, and now it's slipped my mind. About pro wrestling, I can't remember what it is. But yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. You know,
and I thought that overall, except for a couple matches, I thought it was a really successful.
That's it. Thank you. What was your top matches of the weekend? If you had to like make like a top like three or five or whatever you want to make, let's do five since it's.
I'll go in ascending order, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Becky Lynch, Rhea Ripley, mm-hmm. Was really good. I thought that AJ Styles, LA Knight was really good. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to lump these together because I think they're basically like one match continued in the two main events from night one and night two. So the tag team between Cody and Seth and The Rock and Roman, and then the title match on Sunday night. And then this is a toss up, 1A and 1B, I guess. But the Gunther, Sami Zayn Intercontinental match and the EO Sky Bayley women's title match. I think those were both. I think those two were the best matches of the weekend. I think that in terms of just like the action, I think that LA Knight AJ Styles is probably like the match that I enjoyed the most, just because of them like beating the shit out of each other. And although Bayley and Io Sky was like so impressive with the storytelling in that match, and the fact that like they had Bayley, who's another like become another white meat babyface, become these fucking like odds from this woman that like, you know, whatever, knows her better than anyone.
I think it's hilarious that Bayley, Vince has been really gone for 2 months, and like Bayley's already like getting some of that babyface like shine back to her again.
And truly, like over,
she's getting those UK chants for her, like already. Like how long? It's wild, like how different everything feels now with Vince gone.
Like, well, because officially, decisions aren't being made by someone's breast size and hair color,
right?
It's being made by fan reaction and talent. You know, matter what you can say about. You know, we complain all the time about the internet wrestling community being a bunch of like shut in fucks with, you know, no social graces and even less like creative whatever.
And not hearts of gold, right?
The audience tells you what they want to see. Sure. And the way that you don't always got to give it to them. And sometimes you got to like tease it and take it away 100%. Yeah. But the more times that you like let it play out in the way that people like want to see it play out, at least if that's the end result, then it's much more successful. And I think, you know, intriguing. And I mean, look, like he's a heel right now, and he's actually like a heel in real life, I think. But did you watch the TikTok video of Logan Paul marking out to the main event?
Yes, like of all the things
happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
and it's one of those things like where you watch this guy who's playing a character on the same show.
Yeah,
who's a bad guy and sarcastic and snide and cowardly, and act like a fucking like 13-year-old in his reactions to seeing like these people that are probably like among his heroes as a kid.
Sure, sure.
Cena, Undertaker, Rock, like marking out, you know. To use the vernacular or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impressive, and it's,
yeah, it is.
I mean, even more than a soap opera, because soap operas are so tedious in the sense that they constantly build up a story and then bring it back down so they can play it out continuously over the course of like months or years or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that by and large, at least a few times a year, and probably at least like once every pay-per-view, you get something that is surprising and like moves you in wrestling. And that's one of the things, like, so not to like belabor this anything, but you brought up like the competition. It's one of the things that bothers me about the AEW brand of wrestling, and that it just, nothing feels connected. Like, they pretend like they're telling these stories, but they're these really hidden, like, you have to have, like, a deep knowledge of, like, the pasts of people.
Right.
To make the connection that they want you to make. And, like, dude, I can't even watch television shows anymore. I don't got no time. Like, I ain't got the time to sit there and, like, research the complicated history of two wrestlers that wrestled in Japan 20 years ago. to figure out why I should care about like some moment, you know?
Right, right.
But I definitely like the broad strokes that they paint in WWE. I think are much more appealing.
Well, right. Like, they understand how to connect to casuals and stuff like that. And that's the one thing that AEW has never figured out in its 4-5 years or whatever.
The wrestling on AEW is phenomenal.
Sure. Absolutely. There's a lot of talent there. A lot of talent.
But it goes to show that everyone understands the wrestling is fake. So you're not like just watching it just to see two people like jump around the ring and do shit.
Right. You have to have story as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You have to have understandable, tangible story. Like it can't, like you said, it can't be this hidden story like behind it.
WWE does that I really wish AEW would learn from is their fucking video packages.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch a 4-minute video package and understand.
Yes.
Every single point you need to understand about the thing you're about to see.
Yeah.
And the new production of that product is.
Yeah. Leaps and bounds beyond what was. Right. Yeah.
Great. It is to sit there and watch, like, from a production value standpoint.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I've made that point before. It's like if we invited somebody that's never really watched that product over, like for an AEW pay-per-view or something like that, it's like I would have to be sitting there explaining to them during the match, like what the story is
right.
to that match, as opposed to what you do is you cut two matches of 15-minute, like, you know, matches like off the card, and you put like anywhere from like 60-second to 4-minute video packages, depending on, like, you know, where they are on the card in front of those matches, to be able to tell the casual viewer the story, and they might become invested in it at that point, because that's what builds the mythology of those characters and the story and the feud, like, over time, and you have to right. tell casuals that story in order to build myth. And
that's the crazy thing is, like, we have our friend Orion was actively watching AEW for the better part of a year, maybe mm-hmm. more.
Yeah.
And we would still have to explain to him,
right?
Well, it's because this happened in this promotion at this point,
mm-hmm.
and then this happened in this other promotion, and that's, you know, I mean,
right?
I used to make a joke, and I watch more AEW secretly than probably anybody else, because I watch like everything on YouTube, and I even watch the supplemental shows sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't have to watch 8 hours of television a week to understand,
right?
8 hours or 5 hours of television plus 3 hours of YouTube.
Right.
To understand a plot point, you know, agreed. Like tell it to me on the screen.
Right.
Like bringing Cody Rhodes out dressed like a combination of. He looks like a fucking video game character, you know, he looks like Captain Falcon from F-Zero or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then Roman in just his like fatigue pants. With no shirt and angry
tribal, like. Tribal tats and his shark tooth lay, like, you know, I mean, yeah.
You immediately know, like, who is what in that circumstance.
Right.
And they can do that with anyone. Like, you don't ever have to guess, like.
To some degree, who that person is, yeah. The presentation is on point, you know.
Without, like, forcing you to always feel like you have to root for the baby face.
Right.
Like, you don't ever root for a heel unless you truly feel a reason to, and they give you a lot of reasons to not. And I think that's another thing that kind of ruined wrestling for a long time is they made the heels far more interesting than any like good guy.
Sure.
So why would you ever root for the supposed hero to win if the only thing you care about is, you know,
yeah,
the bad guy? Like,
it's, yeah, like, I mean, well, right. I mean, and again, you had one guy at least booking all that stuff that like was not in touch with the average person, and at one point he could pivot based to things that were not of his mind. So in the 90s he could pivot and see, like, Austin was a heel, right, being anti-authority, rebellious, and he could pivot and say, like, oh, they love this guy, because that was the time period and that's how people felt. They wanted to bring down authority, and he could pivot and make Austin the biggest baby face maybe of all time. And then he stopped being able to do that, and he just started shoving stuff down people's throats.
Right, because you're gonna like what I want you to like.
Right, and it's just a one man's ego that kind of like dominated like that business for 20 years. As opposed to, I think, like you said, like people listening to the fans and not always giving them what they want, because you got to withhold things, right? Withholding is a big part of pro wrestling, like a major part of it, but yeah, you got to withhold sometimes, but you got to give them a little bit of what they want at the same time, and not just
every once in a while.
Yeah, every once in a while. Yeah. Yeah, it's like having a taste. you know, just every once in a while, you got to give them a little bit of taste, like, you know, and just keep them like on the hook. Like, there's definitely there's definitely an addiction aspect a little bit to like pro wrestling, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, yeah, we'll talk about it again next year. That's the one time we'll indulge ourselves on pro wrestling to that extent, probably. But, cause I don't like to do that often. Like, if ever.
In the meantime, the tongue is the thing.
The tongue is the thing. But the tongue's not in the cheek.
Right. It's all tongue.
It's all tongue. Yes.
I found 3 movies.
Fantastic. Well, we'll see your tongue movies, and at least hear about 1 or 2 of them next week. So, thanks for listening, everybody. Right. Have a good week.
Deuces.